Hi, this is Jean Bruce Scott.
And Randy Reinholz.
And when we're not busily producing some of the most outstanding Native American theater in Los Angeles,
we always like to check out the best of British audio adventures with Alex Lefchuk and his team of the Midweek Drive.
And Midweek Drive morning editions on Siren FM.
And Southside Broadcasting. Podbean.com.
Back in the day, E.T. said phone home. These days we'd say stay home. Why? Well, there's a pandemic out there, if you haven't noticed. And to actually address the issues and the importance of actually staying home, even if you've had the vaccination, who better than the awesomely talented GP extraordinaire? Yes, she's our favourite advisor when it comes to medical matters. Dr. Sarah Jarvis, welcome back to the programme. How are you?
Thank you very much indeed, Alex. And after an introduction like that, how could I be anything other than marvellous?
Well, again, it's important to get the message across, of course, Sarah, and from your own professional perspective, there are indeed hotspots that have been seen. Jonathan Van Tam obviously said yesterday in the Midlands, et cetera, not too far away from Lincoln. Obviously, Rebecca Bond, who's with us on the call as well today, she's based in Norwich, so I think they're okay. I'm up in Teesside. But it is important that we don't simply say, okay, fine, virus is under control, vaccine is actually there, it's all good, we can go back to business as usual.
Actually, it has never been more important than it is now to do this gradually. We have got a hugely successful vaccine rollout. We have got falling infection rates. We have got falling hospitalization rates. But we have very short memories. We've had great news in the last month. But let's not forget that last month saw 3 in 10 of all deaths from COVID. December and January saw 50% of all the hospital admissions from COVID. 2 weeks ago, hospital inpatients were higher than they were at the peak of the first wave. So although we've made all that great progress, we are at a tipping point. And one of the reasons we're at a tipping point is because there is a real risk. This is the riskiest moment for a so-called vaccine escape variant of the virus. And what I mean by that is a variant that emerges where the vaccine doesn't provide any or virtually no protection. The riskiest time for that is when we've still got high circulating levels in the community, which we still do. We're still on an average of 10,000 people a day. When we've got a lot of the vulnerable people vaccinated, but when we haven't got the so-called mixers, in other words, younger people who are much more likely to be out there when they're not vaccinated. That is the time that this vaccine escape variant is most likely to emerge.
You mentioned younger people. Well, let's turn to Rebecca Bond, of course, based in Norwich. I think, Rebecca, you're a very sensible soul. Obviously, you would be reading English and journalism at the University of Lincoln. There we are. Shameless plug. But, Rebecca, any questions or thoughts with respect to the issues relating to Dr. Sarah Jarvis?
Yeah, I mean, thankfully for the majority of people I know, especially young people, because I think sometimes there's a misconception that a lot of young people disregard the rules from what I've, you know, seen on the internet and things. But from what I've experienced, a lot of people, especially in universities, are really, really adhering to the rules. But as Alex says, people are starting to get their hopes up. They'll be out for summer and, you know, they'll be going to concerts and festivals, and that they're big, big groups of people. Is there any advice for young people that might be planning on attending, you know, big gatherings or anything like that? Would you say it's okay to do so?
Well, I think the first thing to say is you're not going to be attending any of those gatherings if we've had an outbreak of vaccine escape variant. So for now, hands, face, space. I know that the vast majority of young people are adhering. Statistically, however, they are less likely to. Now, that doesn't mean that they all do, but they are statistically much less likely to. So hands, wash your hands really regularly as if you've just been chopping chilies and you're about to put your contact lenses in. 20 seconds at least. Face covering where you can't socially distance, especially where you're indoors, wear a face covering and do not wear it over your mouth only. It does not fit under your nose. It fits over your nose.
That's one Remember of the frustrating things that you see in the shops. And I want to say to strangers, please put it up over your nose. But you just can't, can you? You can't approach strangers and just tell them what to do. I wish I could.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And of course, the problem is it's not there to protect you. It's there to protect other people.
Exactly.
Space, really important. 2 meters apart. If you can't, if you can do it. If you can't, at least try and keep 1 meter apart and think about face coverings, especially if you're indoors. Ventilation. Glorious weekend. Lovely weather on the way, we hope. Spring is springing. Much lower risk of infection outdoors than indoors. But for students, I think if you can stick to those rules, and if really importantly you do get symptoms, you still continue to get tested, you self-isolate, you download the NHS COVID-19 app so that test and trace can or people can be pinged much more easily. And especially perhaps if you're going to be in groups where you don't know everybody, that one is really important. If we all continue to do that and cases do continue to drop, then I think we can genuinely get to a position where we can hope that those festivals may go ahead. Now, at the moment, interestingly, there are going to be some pilot events running from April or late April or May. And what they're going to be doing there is following very closely, testing absolutely everybody and seeing whether we can come after June the 12th, open up more safely without needing to have other things such as whether it's vaccine passports or rapid testing on site.
I think some really good advice there, because although we do have light at the end of the tunnel and it's important to stay hopeful and positive, I think it's still vital, and it's, you know, proven to be vital that we still need to be adhering to these rules. And I would love to say to all young people out there, please do it on behalf of everyone, because, you know, our older relatives would do the same for you. So please do it for everyone else as well.
I couldn't agree with you more. But of course, one point which probably I think has not been in play as much recently is actually, even if you're young, even if your risk of serious complications is very low, you are now doing it for you as well. Because if we end up with rising cases and particularly a variant that the vaccine doesn't work as well against, we could all end up in lockdown again.
And let's move on, Sarah, to the notion of a vaccine, because clearly I think Rebecca and myself will both know people, obviously you will know who, as the vaccine's been rolled out, been receiving their first jab, shall we say. Just remind us who's actually eligible for the vaccine as we move into the next phase and so on.
So everyone over 70, everyone who lives in or works in a care home, all frontline health and social care workers, and anybody who is shielding has already been invited, apart from that extra group, the 800,000 people out of the 1.7 million who were advised to shield for the first time at the beginning of last week. And they are the ones who haven't had the vaccine. The other 900,000 in that group have, but they are being invited at the moment. But we're also inviting everybody who is so-called clinically vulnerable. And that means everybody who has an underlying health condition that doesn't increase their risk as much as the people who are shielding, but does still increase their risk significantly. There is a lot of controversy about the fact that people with asthma, unless they have very severe asthma, are not being invited. All people with learning disability are now being invited, which I think is very gratifying, because I was concerned that people with severe learning disability would be missed if we didn't invite everybody. That's all people with learning disability, everybody with Downs. And importantly, all carers are all being invited. That's everybody from the age of 16 to 64, who, or 16 up to 70, because the 65, 69 year olds are all being invited as well. But next comes the 60 to 65s, after that, the 55 to 60s, after that, the 50 to 55s. And we aim to get to all of those by about the middle of April, hopefully by the middle of April. After that, there is some controversy, because what they've said is we're going to go purely on the basis of age. So people in their 40s next, people in their 30s after that, people in their 20s after that. And the reason that's controversial is that there has been a lot of call for people who are key workers to get their vaccines sooner. Even though their risk of being severely unwell is much, much lower, they are significantly more likely to catch it. Now, my personal feeling is that you could run the two systems in parallel. You could invite all the 40 to 49 year olds, but you could also start identifying all teachers, all police officers, all taxi drivers, public health, public transport workers, etc. There are lots of other people, and there are, you know, foundry workers. There are all sorts of groups, and I appreciate that's complicated. But that's the way they've decided to do it, on the basis that by keeping it simple, they'll get it rolled out as soon as possible and hope to offer a vaccine to everybody over the age of 18 by mid-July.
It's kind of following the same sort of route, really, in terms of time that I suppose the Spanish flu did 100 years ago, or approximately 2 or 3 years, effectively, as the thing is actually rolling through.
Well, except, of course, that we have a vaccine. And Spanish flu killed 50 million people, which is equivalent by today's population to 200 million people worldwide.
Absolutely. And again, I know Rebecca yesterday was quite shocked when we were featuring our author of the week, Canadian Natasha Dean, who was researching the plague in Italy, where they actually had lasagna graves. They call them lasagna graves because they were literally sort of piling things on other, which we don't want to get to that stage. And we want to step really well away from that sort of issue. I'll turn back to Rebecca for the last two questions, because normally, as you know, Sarah, I put them to you. Rebecca, over to you, please.
Yes, Sarah, have you had an enjoyable Zoom with us today?
It is always a pleasure to talk to Alex, but having you as well was an added bonus, so even more enjoyable than usual.
Oh, thank you. And will you be joining us again anytime soon?
I absolutely will. Before I go, I'm just going to remind people, if anyone has any questions, they need to go to gov.uk/coronavirus. And with that, I will sign off and very much hope to be invited back soon.
Fantastic. Many thanks indeed.
Pleasure. All the best. Bye now.
Thanks to Dr. Sarah Jarvis. Fantastic and very sage advice there. Stay at home. Okay, well, Rebecca's still with us as we progress in the next phase of our adventures here, in which we quite clearly say, what a strange and bizarre world it is when a former editor of SFX, the fabulous Dave Bradley, has his birthday on exactly the same day as Robin Pierce. I know, it's astonishing, but one of them's with us now. Hello and happy birthday, Robin Pierce.
Hello, thank you very much. Of course, if you want to keep the genre thing going, it's also very sadly the anniversary of the worst birthday present I ever got, when the great Leonard Nimoy passed away on my birthday. That would be 6 years ago. The passing of an idol indeed.
He transcended, and indeed, as I said at the time on BBC Radio Humberside, he was someone who certainly deserves all the credit that we actually provided for him, and we'll do so. But then, as I say, we celebrate and rejoice in so many ways, as one of my slogans actually once went. Rebecca Bond, as I say, is with us again, and Richard Fitzwilliams, because he always likes to make the grand entrance, clearly is about to sort of arrive and sort of swan in to actually chat about the Golden Globes, which started off in 1945, of course. So literally just a couple of months before you actually entered the planet, Robin, on that basis, which is great stuff.
So, sorry, did you say couple of months?
Couple of months, exactly. I don't want you to know. You're looking very good for your particular chronological sort of time. You know, it's just a wondrous sort of time entirely. And in fact, I've even managed to do a best wishes on Facebook as well at the same time. So that's great. I've shared a feature.
Thank you.
Where we were actually in a non-socially distanced
panel
at the University of Lincoln. It is Richard Robin's birthday today.
Robin, very happy birthday. I didn't know, but...
Thank you, sir.
And what better birthday treat than to actually celebrate it with Richard and Rebecca? That's what I say. I mean, it's an amazing thing.
Absolutely. Anyway. The highlight here.
So let us progress, because of the three movies that were put forward today, two from Richard, of course, and one from Robin, I've seen two of them. I thought I'd do even Stevens to see one from Richard, one from Robin. Rebecca's done the same. I would actually say nip and tuck in many ways for White Tiger and, of course, Vast of Night. That's Vast of Night, not Dead of Night, or indeed anything else with respect to night, but Vast of Night. One I gave 6.5 to, one I would give 7 to. We've also got the Golden Globes. Let's start with White Tiger, Richard. Let's start with White Tiger and actually go into that side of things there, and then we'll turn to Vast of Night, and then we'll have Golden Globes, and then we'll look at your movie, hopefully, if we can squeeze it all in.
Yes, indeed. And I think White Tiger is a movie that it fascinated me, I have to say. I'm just doing a check here because I'd be interested to see how much this movie actually made. Incidentally, have you spotted, now this is a question for you because you're very good at these links with different things. There is a link with White Tiger and Meghan the Duchess of Sussex. What is it?
Well, I mean, I was about to mention the socially distanced on the top of the bus interview that the new White Prince of Bel-Air, Harry, has actually given recently. I suspect it's nothing to do with that whatsoever. Clearly, she won't have actually funded the whole sequence. So, Richard, you're going to have to share with us what excitement these wonderful new royals, as I refer to them as, the new royals, rather like the new mutants in terms of the Avengers universe and the Marvel universe. We have the new mutants. Here we have Harry and Meghan, the new royals. You know, you might like them, you might dislike them, but they're new.
But the link happens to be Priyanka Chopra, who's actually very good, and she is one of Meghan's inner set. And she plays one of the
characters. She plays a wonderful American soul. And, of course, there might also be a connection with Deepak Chopra, of course, who is a wonderful soul who's actually sort of produced all manner of marvellous things, including sort of A Way of Living, which is truly wondrous. There may not be. I just put that out there because Chopra's a wonderful.
That's what I'd mentioned, because she was one of the friends who's quite often appeared in the news. But The White Tiger, it's very colourful, it's very dramatic, it's directed by Ramin Bahrami, and it is set in India, much of it in Delhi. And one of the fascinating aspects of this movie is its structure, because we have an actor, I have to say I didn't know him, Adash Gurav. He's Balram, and Balram we meet initially as a very successful entrepreneur. He talks to camera, and well, the Chinese premier is visiting India, and this is in the form of an email. He looks back over his life story and says why he would like to meet him. And what a story it is. This is a black pop. Social satire, part black comedy. Parts of this reminded me of Parasite. And Bahrami is, he comes from a very poor village. He's told he's a white tiger, that's someone born once in a generation. His father's got lots of problems. He can't pay off the village landlord, so he loses out at school. And he aspires to become a chauffeur for the son of the village landlord, Ashok. Ashok, played by Raj Kumar Rao, a very good performance. All the acting is excellent. Has just returned from America with his American wife, who was the said Priyanka Chopra, plays Pinky. Now, if you're the second driver, surely you've got one ambition, and that's to become the first driver. The way he manages this isn't very nice. But then as we follow this plot throughout, we discover that this is someone who can from time to time, shall we say, be a little unscrupulous, because once he is in Ashok's employ, he has his own agenda, and we have in Ashok someone who is deeply corrupt. He survives by bribing politicians on both sides of the political divide. If there's an election, you make sure that he's not only bribe the winner, but also the opposition. The trouble is, it can be rather a dodgy existence, and it's also dodgy working for such a person. And, it's a ruthless and it's a corrupt society, and huge disparities between the rich and the poor. Obviously, a lot of the message here is social. However, do you become a socialist entrepreneur? This I leave as the challenge without any spoilers, because believe me, there are some very black and dark scenes in this, especially when a road accident might be involved. So what I would suggest is visually stunning. I loved the music, and it seemed to me that first-class cast, not an entirely believable story, all of it, but nonetheless, a fascinating movie and a very, very intriguing. I'd heard good things, and I think that they were very well justified.
Great socialist, of course, one of the characters that actually emerges in terms of the actual movie and the motion picture. And yes, let's be honest, let's hope that Meghan doesn't take driving lessons from the character portrayed by her friend, because it could all end in a metaphorical car crash. But let's move away from that. Rebecca, turn to your good self. We've had a chat beforehand, so you've had some of my thoughts on this already, but what are your thoughts on White Tiger?
So I enjoyed it. I love the satirical criticism of the social and political constructs. I think it addressed some, really deep issues such as classism, but it also made it enjoyable. I think the acting was spectacular, the cinematography was spectacular. I all round enjoyed it. Yeah, I was, you know, hooked the whole way through. I think it had a fantastic storyline. You really get attached to the character, whether that be a good thing or not. You know, you're following a really, really interesting and, you know, one a story with lots of twists. And I think that was what made it so gripping. Yeah, I enjoyed it.
We're all just roosters trapped in a Zoom-like cage, trying to force our way out of the cage, getting from that rooster into a real-life thing. It's too much. And remember, roosters can go crazy, much as, of course, white tigers can, as we actually see. No spoilers, but there's a wonderful midway point in which the narrator actually turns around and says those immortal words, "It's going to get quite dark from here on in." And it's very important to actually acknowledge that it's so, so tempting to actually sort of lapse into a kind of Apu Simpsons-like accent, which I'm holding myself back for, quite really, for obviously reasons of political correctness and so on. We'll step away from that. But there are moments where you think, Ganjidi, where are we going now? But still, it's just wondrous. I would have given this a 7. Not quite perfect. Few issues with respect to other bits and pieces, but still thoroughly enjoyed it. But would that have actually tempted Robin Pierce to actually go to Netflix and say, White Tiger, I'm going for that one?
I'd actually considered White Tiger while I was trying to figure out what I was going to have a look at this week. It was on my list, but unfortunately, sci-fi won the day because at the end of the day, pretty much like The Wild Beast, I am what I am.
This is so true. And that could always have been a line taken from White Tiger. Okay, I think thumbs up for that. I would say, Richard, what would you score White Tiger? I mean, I say I put it in at a 7.
No, I absolutely go for an 8. I found it very gripping, and with the twists in the plot, it's fascinating. Even if, to some extent, as I did compare it to Parasite, because I do think there's a similarity. Eight, it seems fair. It's extremely good. It is. It's also very intriguing, and I thought the device of the some would find so much duration a bit tiring. I thought it was very useful so far as understanding the thoughts of, shall we say, a very unusual social climber.
Very unusual. And it's fair to say, Richard, I presume you do not have any taxi drivers grovelling at your feet at present, basically sort of seeking your advice and wisdom, which is very important. Because who knows? Rebecca, your score out of 10 for White Tiger?
I'd say a 7 as well. Yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed it. I just don't think it's something I'd, you know, watch again or would choose to watch had I not been recommended it. But yeah, it was gripping. I think it was a fascinating story and a really interesting character that was very well developed. So,
and be very wary if you don't like rain and if you don't like bottles and glass, because if you like bottles and glass and rain, all of those things can actually be misused.
I do have to stop you here because you're getting into dangerous territory.
Absolutely. I'm just saying bottles, glass and rain. Just beware.
No, okay. You think too much. You're getting very, very out of control when it comes to these semis.
I'm just stuck in this little Zoom trap. That's the key thing, like a rooster. Moving on. Okay, Vast of Night. Robin, we'll turn to your good self before we actually discuss the Golden Globes and hopefully Judas and Black Messiah. Robin, would you like to share reasons why Robin should actually go and see what I would quite honestly say could actually have been done as a radio play and you wouldn't have noticed the difference? Is it a budget Close Encounters of the Third Kind? Is it something which ultimately kind of you just think, well, okay, it's like French avant-garde cinema in the 1960s, whether you stay on a shot, a bit like this shot of the quartet that we've got at present on screen, where it just stays there forevermore and we actually just have a dimming and it goes from that. However, you may say Vast of Night, it's got Cayuga Publications productions in there. It's a nod in the direction of the Twilight Zone. It's an homage. Take it away, Robin.
Well, actually, when I was looking for something to cover this week, I was just seeing what was out there. I accidentally stumbled upon this film called The Vast of Night, which I had, to be honest with you, never heard of. But it's got a stack of film festival awards behind it, and it seemed to be an intriguing premise. As you say, yes, a little bit of Close Encounters of the Third Kind there. So I thought I'd give it a go, see what was going on. It was written by Andrew Patterson and Craig W. Sanger, and it's directed by Andrew Patterson. Cast of unknowns. And sometimes this is the best thing, because you can invest more in the character if you're not dealing with a major star. So what intrigued me most was that it's set in a New Mexico town in the late 1950s. Now, this is something that plays right into my wheelhouse, because some of my most beloved films are those of Jack Arnold set in New Mexico towns in the 1950s. Films like Tarantula, for example. And of
one
course,
of Richard's favourites, you know. I mean, Tarantula, compared with Lawrence of Arabia, they both have desert activities. It's great.
Oh, I'm trying to skirt around this one. So it had that vibe going for it, which I very much like. So I was really surprised when I tuned in that they start off with a very much a Twilight Zone-like opening, with a Rod Serling imitator doing the clipped tones, the business-like sort of address that he did, introducing this fake 50s sci-fi show. And, of course, we are in the town of Cayuga, New Mexico, named for Rod Serling's production company, Cayuga Productions, which produced The Twilight Zone. Also in there is, of course, a reference to the nearby town of Santa Mira, where Invasion of the Body Snatchers by Don Siegel took place. Strange things have been happening in Santa Mira. They even reference, well, did you hear what happened to the Grimaldi family? The Grimaldi family were the first people to be taken over by the pods in Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Yeah. So there's lots there for a 50s sci-fi nut like myself.
Yeah. I can see Richard already, his appetite has been whetted to look at these intertextual references.
Richard, We'll be shoot me now.
If I may intervene just for a second, to me, the Grimaldi family were the rulers of Monaco for about six centuries.
Yeah. And they were pod people as well.
I just knew when I heard the Grimaldis, and I was going to bring it into here as a piece of trivia, I knew Richard is going to pick up on a historical reference here. I knew it. Richard, you do not let me down ever. Anyway, so it's the night of the first big game of the season in the high school. It's all very 1950s, you know, just on the cusp of American graffiti. But a switchboard operator hears a strange audio frequency, a strange tone. And she's played by Sierra McCormick as Faye Crocker. There's an on-off relationship with a local young disc jockey at the local radio station, which happens to be just across the road, WOTW Radio. WOTW, War of the Worlds, people. So, of course, Everett Sloan listens to this at the radio station, and it's set in real time. One night during that basketball game, and that they investigated, and it comes from beyond the clouds. Now, you might be thinking, oh, good grief, what a ripoff. The style here is completely different. Two young actors, Sierra McCormick and Jake Horowitz, actually carry the entire film. There is a lovely tracking shot from the switchboard.
She's running.
The old switchboards where you used to plug the cords in, right through the town, to the basketball game, out of the gymnasium, and back to the radio. And that shot lasts about 4 minutes, and I thought, it's just tremendous. But even though there's
touch of
really
evil, revisited.
There's a sense of palpable menace there. It's understated. It's not a big special effects extravaganza. It's more of a tone poem of 50s paranoia. And for that reason, I would give this a 7 out of 10.
Oh, well, I'm on 6.5. But what is Rebecca Bond going to say? Rebecca, your thoughts on this interesting and bizarre little offering on Amazon Prime?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. It was, I think, the first sort of indie, I guess you could describe it, film that I've ever seen. It was a shorter running time, obviously, a part of a festival, I believe, when I researched it. It was one of the first in that way. So for me, I really enjoyed it. It had so much packed into a shorter running time. I think having, you know, the two main characters set in that one night really, really worked effectively, and they really, really carried the storyline. I thought that was fantastic. The only thing I found difficult to define was the genre. I was, you know, always thinking, is this horror, is this sci-fi, is it mystery, or is it thriller? And I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. It wasn't confusion, it was more intrigue and, you know, what's going to happen. And, you know, I'm not very well educated on sci-fi, but for this I was really, really gripped. And, you know, the storyline, I think, was fantastic. And to fit that all into such a short running time worked really, really well. And I really enjoyed it.
And your score, Rebecca?
I'd say a 7. I really enjoyed this. And I think it was, as I say, effective in everything it used. I think the music and the dramatic, you know, the climactic ending was fantastic. Yeah, really good.
I'd certainly also give name checks to Gail Kronauer, who plays Mabel Blanche. Gail, of course, tutored as an award-winning actress as well, so a lot of good stuff. And Bruce Davis, of course, as the voice of Billy, which, again, I thought worked well, although I might have trimmed a little bit of the time there. That's why I felt it got a little bit too self-indulgent. Either what way, you've heard the reviews there, Richard. Is Vast of Night something you might say, well, it's only...
One thing I'd like to just point out is this is very much like the X-Files just before Mulder and Scully would turn up. This is what they would be investigating.
Interesting point.
It's like a prequel to an X-Files episode.
That might have totally destroyed the notion of Richard, just as he was getting into the whole notion of, oh, a tarantula's a bit like Lawrence of Arabia. Maybe I should work.
Well, we've got Gillian Anderson, who's been starring in The Royals.
Yes, and actually, Robin, you brought up, it turns out, not exactly my bait noir, but I felt for a while that Gillian Anderson is somewhat overrated as an actress. I say this for this reason, Alex. I heard your intake of breath there, but may I just explain? Firstly, in All About Eve, in the Betty Davis role, I mean, she's simply miscast. It was a play that got bad reviews, and the reason it got bad reviews was that they were projecting, can you imagine it, close-ups of the film, close-ups of the characters on stage at the top of, well, above the stage. In fact, it really, really was a mess, and everyone agreed with that. Where she was very well, highly praised, I have to admit this, was in Blanche in Streetcar, Named Desire. But I have trouble, I have to admit, maybe it's me with identifying with the role. It was a very memorable production. The stage slowly rotated throughout, which was a most intriguing device. But we've just heard, of course, of Gillian Anderson as Margaret Thatcher in The Crown, as you pointed out. Now, the problem here, I recently gave a talk on the way royals have been depicted on screen. And if you take someone like Laurence Olivier, say, who playing Richard III as a sort of waxwork who escaped from Madame Tussauds and been wound up, it simply doesn't work. It was rather like Benedict Cumberbatch's recent Richard in the Wars of the Roses of the BBC. He was so physically dysfunctional, he could hardly, well, just about move. I mean, it appeared surreal. My point is that if these characters as villains are not humans of a sort, however inhuman their behaviour, if it's got no relevance to the human condition, I see no purpose in having them. It was a question of miscasting. I know Peter Morgan hates Margaret Thatcher. We know that he has a tendress for obvious reasons for Gillian Anderson. That's another matter. But when I saw the audience, which is Peter Morgan's play about how the Queen, played by Helen Mirren, and very well, gets on during the audiences with her various prime ministers, excellent performance by Richard McCabe as Harold Wilson. I knew, after having seen Hayden Gwynne's Margaret Thatcher, here was the same problem, which we're about to have when I get to The Crown. Here was the same problem. If you have someone who looks silly, one thing Thatcher did was look for a pretty fierce, and certainly she with every inch a conviction politician, whatever you think of her. That's not the point. The point is Hayden Wynne, who played Thatcher in the audience, looked silly in a suit that simply was a trifle surreal. It just simply didn't convince. Now, here with Gillian Anderson, one thing Meryl Streep did in The Iron Lady, in a role that Paul Gompertz, the BBC Arts editor, compared to King Lear, and that was there was a positivity and a force behind the character. A tragic figure in some ways, and in some ways, well, we know that. But my point is not to discuss Thatcher's legacy, but it is unquestionably, I say tragic because she, of course, suffered from dementia, and that's where the Iron Lady begins when she's suffering. But the problem with Gillian Anderson is the physicality of the role. It's simply not convincing.
Richard, next you'll be saying that Armie Hammer does not make a convincing Ilya Kuryak in The Guy Ritchie Man from Uncle, and that is quite frankly shocking. Robin, it is your birthday. You get the choice then to determine what the next sequence is going to be. Will it be Richard waxing lyrical about the Golden Globes upcoming, or providing us with his thoughts on Judas and Black Messiah? Where would you like to point, Richard? It is your birthday. You have the choice.
Let's go with Judas and Black Messiah first.
Well, indeed. And I have to say, one of the fascinating aspects of this film is its opening, because it's about the FBI informant, William Bill O'Neill, played by Lakeith Stanfield, who betrayed Fred Hampton, played by Daniel Kaluuya, the leader of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party, whom the FBI murdered. It's set in the late 1960s. Now, at the very beginning of this film, we actually see the real Bill O'Neill appearing in a documentary, Eyes on the Prize, which he did in 1989. And after that, he committed suicide. His guilt finally caught up with him, the real one. Then we see what I would call a powerful, well-filmed and pretty tense biopic. And we see how O'Neill is a petty thief. He's blackmailed by an FBI agent, Roy Mitchell, played by Jesse Plemons, and begins working for the bureau run by the bigoted and ruthless J. Edgar Hoover. Martin Sheen, a good performance there. Hoover intends that Fred Hampton is far too dangerous, and so he should be neutralized. He's a very charismatic orator. He can campaign effectively in Chicago. I have to say, and the film isn't always convincing, there's the leader of the chapter of the Black Panthers, which is, of course, a radical political party. He's able to form the multiracial Rainbow Coalition, which is formed, I have to say, far too easily in the movie. But it raises public awareness of political issues. It heightens his profile. He falls in love with fellow Panther Deborah Johnson, played by Dominic Fishbank, and she becomes pregnant. Then O'Neill is blackmailed into helping the FBI stage a raid on Hampton's apartment, drugging his drink, and is murdered in his bed by an execution squad. It's well shot. It has a documentary edge throughout. At the Globes, undoubtedly, Daniel Kaluuya is going to win as Best Supporting Actor for playing Hampton. And he's charismatic, and it's a very effective role. Very interesting, again, yet another example from Daniel Day-Lewis to Lincoln to David Oyelowo and Martin Luther King of British actors playing well-known American figures. But I found the most interesting character study, Lakeith Stanfield's O'Neill, this very uneasy, the psychologically twisted and highly pressurized figure, who apparently, and one of the strengths of this movie is that you get quite a lot of a story about what happened in real life at the end of it. He took $200,000 overall from the FBI and as an informant. And in fact, the Bureau had a suit with reference to this murder, where they finally settled for $2 million, which was pretty unique at the time.
And you think clearly, if they'd actually had Gillian Anderson's X-Files character of Dana Scully actually working for them, they would have actually solved that within the FBI, quite clearly. Interesting that Ryan Coogler, of course, is one of the producers of this, because, of course, also he directed the real Black Panther, as opposed to the fictitious Black Panther. No, different line entirely.
But interesting, by the way, because the Black Panther was the best Marvel movie of all time, and I mean that really, really succeeded. And I think Robin and I would probably agree on that one, because it really was riveting. It was colourful. It used African backgrounds, and it was a stunning, both visually and the casting and the whole concept of it. Worked a treat. The director here is Shaka King, and he sustains the tension very well. Of course, this is the period of BLM, and obviously there's obvious relevance today to what we see in this movie. This is part of the tragedy of America, and it's an insight into, again, another part of its very dark history going back 50 years.
And, of course, Shaka King also co-wrote the screenplay as well. So Judas and the Black Messiah, I think it's HBO that actually sort of carrying this at present. Robin, would you access this? Would you consider actually making the purchase and or renting Judas and the Black Messiah?
Yes, I think so. Yeah. Yeah. Oddly enough, I mean, we mentioned the Black Panther. When the fictitious character was introduced in an issue of the Fantastic Four in the mid-60s, of course, comic books having been, you know, scripted and drawn up several months before publication, that particular issue hit the newsstands the same time as the political group of the Black Panthers came to notoriety and prevalence, and the character had to be retired for a couple of years and reintroduced when everything had died down again.
Exactly. It's the mystical world of Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. Yeah. Rebecca Bond, what about yourself? Is this a movie that you think, you know, I might give that a go?
I think so. It sounds interesting. It sounds relevant as well, which I think is important. So yeah, I might be adding this to my watch list.
Delighted to see that Glenn Close in Hillbilly Elegy could actually be picking up an award from the Golden Globes, which, as I say, has been around since 1945. I suspect, Richard, in the 4 or 5 minutes you've actually got remaining to actually talk about some of the predictions for the Golden Globes, yes, another ceremony where trinkets can be passed out for people who have actually been pretending being other people. Richard, over to you. At least the good news is, before you say, Amy Poehler is co-hosting it. Amy Poehler, the actual voice of Joy from Inside Out, will be hosting it. So, yay! Good news.
No, that is great, because Tina Fey and Amy Poehler will be the co-hosts. Now, we don't know exactly what form the ceremony is going to take. Part will be from Manhattan, part from L.A. The Golden Globes have held their audience. They are 90 members of the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, and they've got this unique spot that they've kept ever since the 1940s. And yes, there's a lot of criticism about some of the choices, including Glenn Close's Hillbilly Elegy, an utterly ridiculous sort of supporting role. But just to concentrate on something positive, because if you want negative press about the Golden Globes and the HFPA's some of their choices. I didn't see Emily in Paris, but that is another that's highly criticised. Da Five Bloods, which of course I thoroughly enjoyed, Alex, talking to your students on Wednesday, isn't even mentioned. I mean, it that's extraordinary. But very, very fleetingly, one hugely positive development. This is the 78th Golden Globe ceremony. In the 77 years, there have been five nominations of women directors. Here there are three out of the five, and we've got Chloe Zhao for Nomadland, we've got Regina King for One Night in Miami, and we've got Emerald Fennell for Promising Young Woman, and it'll almost certainly be Chloe Zhao, but that is something that's positive, yes. Regarding the predictions, well, it could be Promising Young Woman that wins, but it also could be it's Trial of the Chicago 7 is also a possibility. So I think that's an exciting category for the best picture drama. There's no doubt Chadwick Boseman will have a posthumous victory for his superb performance in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, really electrifying, and I think he will deserve that. We know now Carey Mulligan, it was going to be a tight race between Frances McDormand for Nomadland and Vanessa Kirby for Pieces of a Woman. We now know Carey Mulligan is literally got the statuette.
Woman in most cases can actually suffer those pangs of childbirth in certain circumstances.
Not for Pieces of a Woman, of course, but for a promising young woman. When it comes to the comedy and musical, it's always weaker, almost invariably weaker than the drama. And it certainly is this year a lot of controversy whether a filmed play, Hamilton, should be nominated. I do have to say that I think Borat's subsequent movie film, which of course is Sacha Baron Cohen's send-up of Trump's America, that I think we'll win there. I think he'll win for Best Actor, Comedy or Musical, and for Best Actress, Comedy or Musical. We know more or less know Maria Bakalova as his daughter in the film. The famous Mayor Giuliani sequence has gone viral, of course, is going to win, or so it seems. It seems for Best Supporting Actor, I mentioned earlier, Daniel Kaluuya for Judas and the Black Messiah, and he's a very charismatic performer. But I think for Best Supporting Actress, it looks like Amanda Seyfried for Mank as William Randolph Hearst's mistress.
And quite right too, Richard, quite right too. What I will do is I will forward on your predictions to both Robin and Rebecca, and then should they so choose, they can actually sort of access those details. We'll probably talk about it next week. One thing, I'm delighted with your prediction for Best Television Supporting Actress, but unfortunately your comment about Gillian Anderson not deserving it is outrageous. So I'll just sort of leave it there.
Why is it outrageous? She wasn't good as Thatcher. You cut me off earlier when I was talking about she hadn't got, I wasn't able to say why, in The Crown she wasn't, I thought, good. She didn't have the physicality. She pottered around her kitchen. And this is when she was saying, I'm going to go on and on and on.
Well, Richard, she's Gillian Anderson. That's like criticising the Pope because he's you know, there are certain things beyond.
Alex, there's a very great deal. Now, you mentioned the Pope. Don't get me started. I could criticise him on a lot of issues, sensitive issues. Gillian Anderson simply wasn't up to the role of Thatcher. She hadn't the physicality Meryl Streep had in The Iron Lady, and she was such an obvious villain. She was
Gillian, like if you're listening to this, you know we always fight your corner. That's all I will say.
She was like the Wicked Witch of the West. And looked like.
And on that bombshell, Rebecca, it's time for you to blow that whistle of peace and harmony and actually sort of ask those last couple of questions. Over to you, Rebecca.
Thank you. Robin and Richard, have you had an interesting Zoom with us today?
Oh, it's been a blast.
Happy birthday, Robin.
Yes, happy birthday. Richard and
happy
me.
Happy birthday. Very happy birthday, Robin. Yes,
Thank you, sir.
Will you both be joining us again in the near future?
Oh, yes, unless there's a restraining order.
We're stuck like in that coop trying to get out. It's like a white tiger. Richard Fitzwilliams, Robin Pierce, and Rebecca Bond, keep on keeping on. We will speak with you again post Golden Globes.